Wrath. So begins European literature, with the first word of the Iliad. A new translation by Emily Wilson, wildly acclaimed, though not unanimously, has once again focused minds on this great work, which, in the wretched time of war we are experiencing, is as pertinent and as resonant as ever. Welcome to EI Talks, the podcast that takes ideas seriously. I'm Paul Lay, senior editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm joined by Alistair Benn, deputy editor of EI and, significantly, a classicist with an intimate knowledge of the Iliad. Now, Alistair, I've made the claim, it's a claim often made, that the Iliad represents the very fount of European literature, its very source. Is this claim justifiable? Does it stand up?
The Iliad is one of the great tributaries of Western culture. Simply put, it's the archaic inheritance of the Near East and the Mediterranean, and a record of the creative encounter between nomadic tribes and settled communities, raiding, farming, island peoples, the men of the Greek islands in their swift black ships, and the men of the city, high-walled Troy, with its spacious streets. And it is that archaic heritage that is then transmitted into the culture of Greece and then Rome, and that great sea of story which continues even today to exert a near oceanic influence on our culture, whether we are conscious of it or not. So the Iliad is an artefact of an Iron Age culture transmitted through the years in stories and oral folk culture and then recorded and set down in the relative tranquility of the Bronze Age, a period when Greek society develops rapidly, city-states get bureaucracies, develop law codes. So you could say that the Iliad, the world of the Iliad, reflects the mores and norms of a pre-civilized society recollected in a more civilized age. Italo Calvino has 14 definitions of what makes a classic, and the Iliad meets the standard for all 14 definitions. And my favourite definition he gives is as follows. Your classic is a book to which you cannot remain indifferent and which helps you define yourself in relation or even in opposition to it. And in cultural terms, the Iliad is the same. No culture which has encountered the Iliad in a serious way has remained indifferent to it, to its strangeness, its visceral impact, its grandeur, its magnetic pull. And many other classics of Western literature are literally inconceivable without the Iliad. That figure of the tragic hero who sticks to their own sense of right and wrong in defiance of the community. I'm thinking of Antigone, especially here. Those figures who suffer at the hands of fate as a result are incomprehensible without Achilles, the central figure whose wrath drives the action of the Iliad as the model. Even Socrates, who's basically the opposite of Achilles in physical stature, he was famously ugly, was not a fighter. He invokes Achilles at his trial as a model of moral courage.
And Achilles, of course, is the great hero of the Iliad. Let's date the Iliad, the creation of it. 8th or 7th century, I presume. You talk about this long gestation, I suppose. Memories of Mycenae, perhaps, first great Greek civilization there that's been worked upon. And also the big question of it being a work of many people or one person, Homer, of course. And this brings in this idea of it being a product of an oral tradition as well.
Yeah, it's worth remembering that the world of the Iliad is as far removed from the era in which we think the Homer, in inverted commas, who collects the stories, gives them shape and power, although he certainly is more than just an editor of things that are already happening. There's clearly a creative will that pervades both the Iliad and the Odyssey, and we can get onto later what the differences are. That Homer is as far removed from that world, the world described in the poem, as, to give a more contemporary example, the monks of the Abbey of St. Gall are from who are great manuscript makers and collectors, are from the world of Jesus and the early Christians.
Yep.
The martyrs, the mad saints on pillars, Antony the Great fighting demons in the desert. That world is potentially over 1,000 years earlier in real historical time than the time in which it is set down. I like the writer Adam Nicholson, who says that Homer reeks of long use. That's the quote. And I think that's very true. There is a kind of clarity and a beauty in the Greek that feels like it's so well worn that, you know, it's as if it's been passed through many hands. But again, there is someone who records it eventually
and makes it canonic and, in that sense.
Yes. And I think we got to, like with a lot of classics, you have to go through a process of distancing yourself from your own assumptions. Homer, whoever Homer was not like T.S. Eliot, for example, sitting with the whole wealth of Western culture behind him, sitting, what am I going to select here and here in a very self-conscious way. Homer would have just lived within the sea of story. It would have, these stories would have been part of everyday life. There would have been reference points. There would have been, roughly the kinds of commonsensical phrases that people associate with Christianity. It would just have been the water he swam in, the air that he breathed.
Yeah.
So it's not as if some rational poet sits there and decides what was important about these cultures and sets them up. They are one story among many. And actually within the poem you have so many stories which could be whole novels, whole books of their own within the poem itself. There are many poems within the poem.
So let's go back to that absolutely basic tale of Troy, which is literally what it is. Can you give us the outline of the basic story? Because it's one of literature's great simple plots. It's one short episode, essentially, with a 10-year war, the Trojan War. Can you summarise that for us?
I think that's actually a harder question than it first appears. Because the Iliad, in a sense, contains a whole universe and a whole universe of story, it's hard to know where to begin. Do you begin with where people, with Achilles' upbringing, for example, or do you begin with the first story that sets the Greek ships on their journey towards Troy?
Yeah.
The poem doesn't start there at all. It starts mid-story. So let's start from where the text starts. It begins with a quarrel between Achilles, who is the greatest warrior, and Agamemnon, who is the greatest leader, over loot and treasure. In this case, they're slave girls. So Agamemnon has to give up his slave girl, Chryseis, to placate the gods, and he takes, in a kind of pretty nasty way, he takes Achilles's instead, who is called Briseis, and that is sort of major disrespect in the Homeric world.
Yep.
That is intolerable for Achilles. So Achilles calls on his mother, who's called Thetis, who is a goddess, who Zeus, the grace of all the gods, and the ultimate referee of the fates of mortals, actually owes a favour to. And this is another way in which these heroes are in some way removed from the cultures in which they're being talked about. They are the sons of goddesses. They're much closer to the divine world than we are.
Yep.
So Achilles basically asks Thetis, and I quote, to help the Trojans and to trap the Greeks between the ships and salty sea, to die so all of them can profit from their ruler, and Agamemnon, son of Atreus, can recognise his own insanity. And I'm quoting from the Emily Wilson translation. So if you were coming to the text cold, you wouldn't really know why the Greeks are outside Troy or have been plundering the towns about and getting slave girls. So that information actually comes a bit later in the poem.
Yep.
But again, it wouldn't have mattered to a listener. They would have just been like, oh, you're starting there. So every listener would know the background. So why do the Greeks sail to Troy? Because Helen, who is goddess-like in beauty and character, she runs away from Menelaus, her husband, with a Trojan prince, Paris. And she knows the consequences will be war.
Yep.
This is the world in which these characters are operating. It's pretty brutal. It's a brutal logic.
And it's an honour society.
It is, yes. And honour is everything. And when Achilles loses his honour, it's just kind of stripped from him, he loses his purpose. Yep. He knows that he's going to die young. But the trade-off for Achilles is that he will get great honour as a result. And when Agamemnon takes away his honour, he says, well, I'm not going to fight because I'm not even going to get honour in my short life. So Helen, she runs away, and she kind of acts like a careless god. Like, this is how the gods behave. They just act without no thinking of the consequences, really. But when we meet Helen in the poem, she's very much full of regrets and is a figure on a much more human scale. But the opposite is true of Achilles, who becomes less and less recognisably human as the poem progresses.
He's a kind of Superman.
He enters into a kind of zone of experience which oscillates between being a beast and a god. Mm. He stops sleeping, he stops eating, but we'll get to why he becomes like that. Because he doesn't start off that way. And actually, at the very end, he kind of returns to his human form and acts in a recognisably human way. So Achilles, he's said, I'm not going to fight anymore, and he sticks to his word. Even after the Greeks beg him to come and fight and give him all kinds of actually quite good reasons why he should just, come on, you know, get over your problem with Agamemnon, we'll sort it out later. And he just goes, no, I'm not going to do that. But eventually he sort of half relents, just when the Greeks are at their lowest ebb, and he sends out his childhood friend Patroclus to fight in his own armour. Hector, the great Trojan prince and son of Priam, the sort of leader of Troy, kills Patroclus. Achilles then goes absolutely berserk and is out for revenge. He actually gives a speech to the Greeks saying, you know, I'm kind of going to start fighting again now, like I'm over it. But in the speech, it's kind of horrifying. He just says, all I want to do is kill Hector. There's no mention about, like, I want to help my friends or anything. Mm-hmm. It's just like, I'm going to go for Hector. I want him dead.
This is personal.
Yeah. He does kill Hector. And what he does after he kills Hector is breathtakingly horrible. He despoils the body. He drags the body behind his chariot while sort of outrageously giving Patroclus like a magnificent burial, full honours, extravagant funeral games. Funeral games, some argue, with the inspiration for the first Olympics, which took place in the 8th century. The funeral games in the Iliad have foot races, there's boxing, chariot races. That's another reason why you should read the Iliad, because it's got stuff in it which we take for granted as just things human beings do.
And these are looked over by the gods as well as spectators, aren't they? These competitions, these tournaments.
Yes, exactly. And the gods often intercede in the action of the Iliad. In fact, there's some interesting sort of psychological research which talks about how these ancient people saw the gods. And there's often points in the Iliad where the characters have thoughts, as if the thoughts are placed in their brains by the gods. And there are psychologists who say, well, this is an interesting reflection of them trying to work out where the unconscious is. You know, why does that thought pop into your head at just that moment and then you go and do it? What's the relationship there? Anyway, so Hector gets, just to return to the action, Hector gets no funeral. And this is a kind of outrage, really. But how the poem ends, Priam, the Trojan king, spirits himself into the Greek camp and he begs Achilles to restore Hector's body home in probably one of the greatest passages in all literature, in my opinion. Achilles relents and suddenly diminishes from this kind of Superman, sort of godlike way
beast.
Of acting. This beast god. And he relents, he cries that Priam and Achilles share their tears. And Hector is given the honour he deserves as a great warrior. And that, roughly speaking, is the plot of the poem.
So it's a relatively simple plot.
It is simple.
In its skeleton.
And there's a lot of kind of battle scenes and there's a lot of kind of the gods having their own arguments.
Yep.
But that is the absolutely simple structure. But, as I say, the Iliadic universe is so vast, and that's reflected in the biographies of the fighters, which are so sort of lovingly related. Mm. So many of these kind of tiny characters within the scope of the poem are given really interesting backstories. You know, you find out where they're from, the little bit of mythology that attaches itself to their name.
Because it's drenched in mythology, isn't it?
Exactly.
As is the Greek world.
Yeah, and there are so many poems within the poem that give it its kind of... We can't possibly know what it was like for these people to hear in the 8th century, for these people to hear these poems while having the full range of association at the forefront of their mind, which they surely would have. You know, there are so many occasions in the text where, you know, someone is referenced and instantly you would know the whole story, and it's put in a slightly different way. There's a kind of astonishing shift, narrative shift. It's just, we can't know.
So you, Alistair, you know the Iliad and the Odyssey in the original Greek. I have read it only in English translation. What is missing in the translation? What is there that's unique about the original Greek Iliad?
So to answer that, I'll just explain what kind of Greek the Iliad is in. It's in a regular meter, in poetic terms, dactylic hexameter, which is a structured combination of long and short syllables. Mm-hmm. And it sticks to the same structure throughout. So what does that mean? It's like la, 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 la. And then it has a la, la at the end of the line. So I think it's the sound that's really important in creating effect. And what is that effect? It's a certain bite, a certain acridity. The words produce sort of bright colours. The sounds almost kind of mark the minds. It's got a kind of really viscous feeling. And Homeric Greek is actually certainly quite easy to read once you're in the flow of it, because there are formulae which repeat throughout the text.
Yeah.
So there's swift-footed Achilles.
Yeah, and this is
the oxide dog face, an insult that urgently needs rehabilitating. And the best translations certainly convey some of that kind of physical, almost the physical violence of the way it sounds and the way it proceeds.
We've mentioned already Emily Wilson's new version of the Iliad. She's already translated the Odyssey to great acclaim, similar acclaim, though, as I say, not entirely universal, of her translation of the Iliad. I know you're a fan. You're positive about it. You think it's a great achievement. How would you characterise Wilson's translation of the Iliad?
Well, she uses regular iambic pentameter.
So this is Shakespearean.
Yeah, which she calls, and I quote, the closest equivalent in the Anglophone poetic tradition to the original's dactylic hexameter.
And yep,
that's very hard to argue with. It's true. Iambic pentameter, for an English reader, it recalls centuries of wonderful verse that we have, in the same way as dactylic hexameter recalls, for many Greeks, it would have been the standard verse form in archaic Greece.
Yeah.
So iambic pentameter is da-dum, 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 which is why bad Shakespearean actors always sort of get up and go da-da-da-da-da. And so it does sound different to the Greek, of course, and but I think that just reflects that we're speaking English, you know, which you're producing different effects. But I think it's an excellent translation. I think it's a truthful translation.
You're convinced?
Yeah, I think it's very, very good. And it conveys something of the spirit of the original. And there are many translations which also convey the spirit of the original. Robert Fagel's The Standard Modern Verse Translation. That's very good. Something like Chapman, he was brilliant. Yep. You know, that still stands up centuries on from when he translated it.
Of course, inspiration for Keats as well.
Of course. And the... and you have translations like War Music by Christopher Logue. Christopher Logue didn't read it in the Greek. He translated the Iliad from other translations.
Yeah.
George Chapman was exactly the same. He never read it in the Greek, but he produced a translation, which is a very, very fine translation.
And this is not entirely uncommon in translation.
It's not uncommon. But the thing about Emily Wilson, she is a very gifted classicist.
Yeah, yeah.
And she is, I think, again, I would say it's a very truthful translation. And I think that is about the highest praise I can give. I've really enjoyed reading it, and I've had moments where I've read passages that I really enjoy, and it's hit a slightly different note, and it's given me something different. And so, yeah, I thank you for that.
So what would those passages include in the Wilson translation?
Well, I think the moments in the Iliad which are the most affecting are when the terrible reality of the events sort of gives way slightly to another view, a kind of another reality, a sense that there is a redemption at the heart of it all. And that kind of emerges through maybe a moment of contemplation, reflection, a pause in the onward rush of it all, because it feels quite quick at times.
It's very pacey.
The action sort of hurries on over itself. And this shift in perspective can actually be very startling and breathtaking on occasion. The encounter between Achilles and Priam is probably the most famous. In terms of the way it just almost catapults you out of that terrible reality. And but the piece of description that for me best encapsulates why the Iliad is still worth reading, actually, and how fresh it is in spite of the passage of so many centuries, is as follows. So Helen is sitting with Priam. This is a wonderful moment. He asks her to tell him all about the Greek warriors that she knew. You know, what are their qualities? Who's the best at fighting? Mm-hmm. He's sort of saying that they look like such admirable fellows. Tell me about them. And it's just a really intimate personal moment. Intimate personal moment. So Helen picks out Ajax, Agamemnon, and then she pauses. And I quote from Emily's translation here. Now I can see all of the quick-eyed Greeks whose names I know, except for two commanders in the army, Castor the horseman and the boxer Pollux, my full-blood brothers. We all shared a mother. Perhaps they did not march from lovely Sparta, or else they did sail here across the sea. But now they do not want to join the fighting, frightened of all the insults and the shame levelled at me. She said this while already they lay beneath the earth, the source of life, back home in Sparta, in their own dear land. And every family member waiting on a reply to a letter that never comes from a son or a daughter fighting in a far-off land will find that excruciatingly resonant. It's that sudden shift of perspective you see, that pulling out, that gives the poem its exceptional grandeur.
And the humanity. And its humanity. Well. Yeah, absolutely. And particularly pertinent at this moment in time. When I first read it, as a teenager, as I recall, it seemed extraordinary, visceral and violent to me. And I'm not one who's particularly squeamish about these matters. I will say that the violence is very direct. It's certainly unflinching, but it tends to be very sudden. There's not a kind of gruesome element of lingering over the victims. They die almost instantly, however bloody that is. What does that say about the mindset of the Greeks?
Just to return to what I said before, this is the kind of the trace of an old culture recollected in a time which probably would have had a different view of violence. So even among the kind of earliest of Homer's fans, they might have found precisely the things you're talking about tricky.
Yeah.
But if we, you know, we then move into the classical period, Plato didn't want Homer in his ideal society.
Yeah.
Although the number of times characters in Plato invoke or criticise Homer is kind of a tribute to his extraordinary potency. And one of the reasons Plato doesn't like Homer is because he doesn't portray death as a departure to a more glorious afterlife.
Yeah.
So in the Iliad, the heroes die and pass into a kind of undergloom, And that's sort of that. Characters sort of speculate about what people might be thinking in Hades, but you don't get to talk to them. They're gone. Plato's citizen warriors, they shouldn't fear death.
So it's unflinching in this.
It's unflinching. And, you know, if you look at Plato's view, he wants his ideal warrior to look forward to his just reward.
Yeah.
And to go to death without fear. And I think that's a way less realistic view of what motivates conflict and the character of death and violence. So sort of like it or lump it, the Homeric attitude to death in its starkness, it focuses in stark form what is valuable about life, and life flows through the poem in the most abundant, most vivid way. Of course, there's so much violence in the Iliad, but there is, I think in almost no other poem is there an emphasis so much on how important what we do, how important it is that we live properly in the present here, right now.
Yeah, and we've spoken already that Emily Wilson has already translated the Odyssey to great acclaim. We now have both the great works of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey in Wilson's translation. It allows us not only to compare her translations with predecessors, but also to compare those two books. What's the relationship between the Iliad and the Odyssey?
Well, yeah, both poems were, we think, written down in the 8th century BC.
And so they're roughly contemporaneous, if we bind to the same author.
They're intertwined with each other.
Yeah.
So, for example, you might expect the sacking of Troy to be the climax of the Iliad, but it's not.
Yeah.
That comes in the Odyssey.
Yeah.
But I think the poems do convey a very different worldview. In the Odyssey, death is viewed in quite a different way. So Odysseus actually travels to the underworld and speaks to the death. I think that would probably be impossible in the kind of universe of the Iliad.
Yeah.
So while they share common roots and a common sea of story, they do embody that different worldview. The Iliad is also set in one place, just about, and the Odyssey has scenes in several.
Yeah, because it's very constricted in time and space, the Iliad, isn't it?
Very constricted. I mean, Achilles is locked into one tragic fate.
Yeah.
Odysseus is always shifting the goalposts, always changing. He's a very different kind of figure. But I think how we have to think about it, perhaps in a modest way, is to say that the Iliad and the Odyssey are different because they have then taken on lives and critical traditions that kind of marked them out from each other.
Mm.
And each of them has given its own attractions to different cultures at different times over the last millennia. So it doesn't. The difference is, to me, part of the beauty of that archaic tradition, that we don't just have one worldview, we've got two.
Mm.
It's also the beauty, in some ways, of the European cultural tradition. We have many sources that have flowed into it, the traditions of the Old Testament, the Gospels, the Hebrew Bible is as rich a font of stories as any other, and also interacts with that Near East, Gilgamesh, all these other epic traditions. That's not really a very good answer about why they are different.
I suspect it's an answer that's ultimately unanswerable.
Yeah.
But the Iliad has been enormously influential. And influential on the later classical world, of course. I mean, I'm particularly have in mind here the Aeneid. I mean, that's the great Roman classical work. What's its relationship to these two great Greek works?
Well, the Aeneid, like the Odyssey, is this kind of sequel to the events which take place in the Iliad. Aeneas, the hero of the Aeneid, is a Trojan who plays an active, though junior, role in the events of the Iliad. But the Aeneas of the Aeneid is a very different kind of hero to the Homeric hero. His relationship to history is very different. He's a founder of a culture and a city and a world. of the Roman world and faces like completely different obligations and constraints compared to a character like Achilles or indeed Odysseus. So Homer, for the Romans, I mean, every educated Roman would have had absolutely been familiar, and it was kind of an absolute given. Homer is a reference point. It's a foundational text. It's a source of debate. You just can't get away from the Iliad and the Odyssey. And the Homeric models are constantly debated over for centuries afterwards.
And does the difference between Homer and Virgil, the author of the Aeneid, tell us anything about the difference between the Greek and Roman worldview?
Well, what I meant when I said that Aeneas faces different obligations, he's a figure in history, very self-consciously so.
Yeah.
And a figure within a literary tradition which has already developed degree of sophistication.
It's established.
Yeah. So Virgil's got a completely different job, if I could put it like that. Aeneas goes through some of the same things that Homeric heroes go through.
Yeah.
He's far away from home, he gets shipwrecked, he visits the underworld, but he's now doing it within a grander historical setting,
and
which results in real historical events.
And he's doing it in the shadow of the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Yeah, and also in the shadow of what is to come.
Yeah.
And a kind of knowledge, a half-knowledge of what he is going to become within the history of Rome, which, let's remember, was the greatest ancient culture of its time and had a very, very self-aware view of itself. So, you know, for Virgil, he's constructing, you know, Julius Caesar claimed descent from Aeneas. So Aeneas is a more historical figure. There are, in the 19th century in Europe, people thought of Homer as kind of history. Lord Byron was like, I think I paraphrase, but he said, if these characters aren't real, they didn't actually exist, then they mean nothing to me. And this craze for Homer in the 19th century, you know, was kind of buttressed by so-called like archaeological discoveries.
Well, the discovery of Troy.
Well, yeah, by a German businessman called Heinrich Schliemann, who claimed that he'd found the real historical Troy in northwest Turkey, and he kind of did that through showing, being a bit sneaky with the dating. And you've got to remember how present Homer was in the 19th century. Like Gladstone, William Gladstone, the giant of British liberalism, was a Homer obsessive. He wrote loads of commentaries and books about him.
And the classics
Homer.
In general.
Yeah, the classics in general were much, much more familiar. I mean, I went to a school in Scotland where the prefects were called effers after the officials of ancient Sparta. It was so self-consciously classicising. That's true also in Germany as well. So if we're thinking about about history and how that interacts with the text, I think Rome's quite a good example, because the Aeneid is the epic of a culture which has started, which is just much more self-conscious of itself.
And it's real.
It's real.
We can feel it. It's there. It's tangible.
Yeah, and I prefer the Aeneid, actually. It's my favourite text in all classical literature. And maybe because I'm more familiar with Latin literature than Greek. I get more of that range of reference when I'm reading it, which is why I say it is so, it's a wonderful incomprehensibility to us what it was like for the early listeners of Homer to listen to it.
Yeah,
because it would have been a really sublime experience, a sort of what Wagner is to modern culture sort of thing. It would have been totally life-changing, I think.
Yeah. Revolutionary.
Yeah, it was absolutely revolutionary.
And that, you talk about the 19th century, of course, and the importance of Homer to European culture in particular, as well as North American culture as well. What influence does it have on modern literature? It does persist. I mean, I suppose most famously, in terms of Homer, we have Ulysses. I suppose that would be the classic example, but there are many others.
Well, W.H. Auden's The Shield of Achilles.
Yep.
Some of the greatest Anglophone poetry there is, which is a modern update of the beautiful, peaceful world which the god's armourer Hephaestus inscribes on Achilles' new shield when he gets replacement armour for the armour that he gave to Patroclus.
Yeah.
So in the Iliad, I mean, this is the poem of war. Well, Simone Weil called the poem of force. But on that shield, if you read it, it's just symbols of peace, the beautiful dances. It's a glimpse of that other world that's not in the poem. That there was a world in which peace was possible for these people.
Yeah.
It wasn't just all war. They were fighting for something. They were fighting for the chance to go and plough their fields in peace, mm-hmm. to celebrate life. But on Audenshield, he writes, there is, and I quote, quite another scene. This kind of updated 20th century shield. Barbed wire enclosed an arbitrary spot where board officials lounged. And there's a ragged urchin who cannot conceive, and I quote, of any world where promises were kept or one could weep because another wept. And there's an explicit contrast here with the world of the Iliad,
yeah.
that Auden shows, because in fame, as we talked about, Priam and Achilles mm-hmm. weep together. And on the modern battlefields, I suspect Priam, if he'd have tried to approach the Greek camp, would have been gunned down, or he would have been tortured to death if he had even tried to do what he does in the poem. So I think there's an element here where when we talk about violence in the poem,
yeah.
we can the poem deals directly with violence, but it does hold out that redemptive common humanity at the end of it all. And I think that's a very important thing to keep in mind. The Iliad continues to pop up in very unexpected places. And I'm really thinking of kind of film and television, which are the preeminent contemporary art mm-hmm. forms, the one that most people watch. The Vietnam War film Platoon is a pretty direct retelling of the Iliad. But there are many other examples. The Amazon Prime series Vikings starts off with a typically Homeric argument over loot and who gets to keep what, and who is the best, greater leader, the great warrior or the leader of men. Mm. It pops up everywhere. It's a kind of archetypal story. So I always think when anyone watches a war film and there's a great leader having an argument with a great warrior, think about the Iliad, because yeah. it's probably a lot of the substance has been mulched over in the Iliad, and you can get good answers there.
It got there first.
Yeah.
And so let me finish with a final question here. Why does the Iliad remain essential reading?
I think the poem would be essential reading even if we didn't live in a world which is marked by the kinds of terrible war and crisis that is in the poem. And the poem begins with a kind of with trouble and crisis. It's sort of trouble brewing in that first book between Agamemnon and Achilles. I say that because it is so powerful and so universal in its essential message. But it is especially urgent that we return to it, because ultimately the Iliad is about finding common humanity in the direst of circumstances, in the most unexpected of places, how we can bear the unbearable. How can we, like Priam, kiss the hand of him who killed his son and move that person to pity and to tears? How can the murderer and the victim sleep soundly near each other after all the carnage, as Priam does after he meets Achilles? How is that possible? And it's in societies which do face recurrent conflicts, thankfully at the moment not our own, these are questions that are being asked and answered every single day. So in a world in which that common humanity feels dreadfully elusive, and in which, you know, to quote Thucydides, the strong do what they will and the weak suffer what they must, Homer remains absolutely essential because it embodies a mindset which sees with clarity how terrible life is, but encourages us to keep on living and affirms that life is worth living in the end. And let's remember, John Keats talks about him a little bit, a great lover of the Iliad. When he discovered the translation, Chapman's translation of Homer, he stayed up all night with a friend, and they looked for their favourite passages and compared notes and sort of sat there in glee. And I love that image of them saying, go to book 8, go to that bit. It's wonderful. in his wonderful poem Endymion, he invokes passion poesy's glories infinite, and he writes of the grandeur of the dooms we have imagined for the mighty dead. Honour the mighty dead that you find this poem. Read the poem, and you really won't be disappointed.
Well, thank you, Alistair, for that very detailed and rich odyssey, if you'll excuse the pun, through the Homeric world. I greatly enjoyed Emily Wilson's translation of the Odyssey, so I'm very much looking forward to her translation of the Iliad, which has just been published. And as you say, there could hardly be a more urgent question, the questions raised by the Iliad, and to a certain extent, the answers they provide. They couldn't be more urgent. So thank you. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.